the year.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as a Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from the Remnants magazine. Get started. You know, we finished Christmas, and can you believe I'm already having a type 2020? Is that amazing? But how about this? This is a holdover from the Christmas stories. But let's talk about this one. It's called Winging It. A Navy pilot devises a tactical plan to get back home for Christmas. This is by Jim Gallagher of New York. During the 1980s, while our son Kevin was in the Navy, we considered ourselves fortunate that, with a very few exceptions, we could spend Christmas with him most years. One year, though, he came home around December 15th, saying it was the best he could get. That was that Christmas Day leave was out of the question for him. So we celebrated the holiday early, complete with a tree and gifts, and Kevin returned to his base a couple of days later. Yet, as Christmas Eve neared, who should show up but Kevin, ready to celebrate Christmas for the second time that year, having somehow received more time off. Of course, we were delighted, and we rushed around to find a few last-minute gifts to exchange on the holiday. But the best gift was having Kevin home again. It was a lucky break that kept our streak alive. We knew our run of good luck couldn't last, so we were grateful while it did. In fact, a few years later, we were sure that streak had ended when Kevin told us during his Thanksgiving leave that there was no way he'd be able to make it home for Christmas. His ship, the aircraft carrier USS Ranger CV-61, would be at sea until after New Year's Day. So my wife Catherine and I had no plans for Christmas that year, other than to sleep in and enjoy a quiet holiday at home. Then on the morning of Christmas Eve, we heard a knock at the front door. It can't be Kevin, we thought. We ignored the knocking, hoping whoever it was would go away. But the caller was persistent. Finally, Catherine couldn't stand it anymore and got up to answer the door. The next thing I heard were shouts of joy and surprise, which could mean only one thing. It was Kevin. How could it be? It turned out that our son had come up with a clever strategy on the spur of the moment. His job gave Kevin access to details about the Ranger's position on any given day. When he saw the schedule, he realized he might be able to manage a trip home. So he asked for and was granted Christmas leave. His shipmates, meanwhile, made fun of him for requesting time off at Christmas when their vessel would be somewhere in the middle of the Pacific Ocean over the holiday. But Kevin knew something they didn't. With Christmas approaching, Kevin guessed there would be an overabundance of mail for the almost 4,000 crew members aboard the Ranger, and getting that mail would be crucial to the crew's morale. So Kevin volunteered to retrieve the mail at the fleet post office in Hawaii. But the ship's position relative to Honolulu meant it was out of range of the usual mail-run aircraft, which was a Grumman C-2 Greyhound. However, Kevin flew S-3 Vikings, which have a greater range than the Grumman's. With another Viking pilot, he flew to Hawaii, and they loaded the jet with the crew's Christmas letters and packages until it looked for all the world like a modern Santa's sleigh. When Kevin handed the Viking's keys to the other pilot to take the presents to the ship, then headed to the airport to start his leave with a commercial flight to New York to spend the holiday with us. A few years ago, our son retired from the Navy with the rank of commander. I like to think it was Kevin's skill at creative planning that gave him an advantage in his military career. Great story, and a great surprise for his folks. What a great day. Here's one about folks who worked hard to bring the Christmas trees to us before Christmas. This is by Philip Radcliffe of Largo, Florida. It's called Lumberjacks for a Day. Friends take a whack at selling Christmas trees. My friend Bob Ruzicka had 16 acres of Christmas trees in Wild Rose, Wisconsin, that were too much for him to cut and sell. My pal Fraylin Smokey Campbell and I made a deal with Bob that we would do the work and split the profit with him. We drove 150 miles to the tree farm. We all lived in Waukesha County. On a beautiful Saturday, we picked the best trees and marked them with red yarn so we could still see them in case of heavy snow. The following Saturday, we returned to the tree plantation in zero-degree weather and with snow on the ground. We cut the first five trees and had to stop. The chainsaw we rented was very heavy, and we had to bend down and hold the saw level a few inches above the ground to cut through the trunks. It was easier to use a bow saw for the rest of the trees. We'd brought a cement culvert, also very heavy, to pull the trees through, which made them more compact for tying and stacking. We hauled the first load of trees in the dark. The A&W stand in Wild Rose was closed for the winter, and the parking lot seemed like a perfect spot to sell the trees. We set them up, but when we returned with our second load, someone had pushed a large tree through the window of the restaurant, a $50 repair on top of the cost of renting the lot. On our third and final trip, it began to rain, which made the trees extremely heavy. Besides the work of unloading, we had to haul trees from the back of the lot to replace the ones that had already been sold. We both had other jobs back home, but when we sold the trees whenever we could, we gave away some to people who couldn't afford them and donated a big one to the church. In the end, we didn't have much money to share three ways, but Smokey and I had an unusual holiday work experience to remember. A sidebar, a Christmas tree crop is deeply rooted in investment, and the popular varieties take the longest to grow. Balsam, Fraser, and Douglas, all firs, grow slowly, up to a foot a year in ideal conditions. These in-demand varieties take 7 to 10 years to reach Christmas tree height. How many of you go camping and have some of those wonderful long bus-like campers that go in, and it's like modern being away, not being away from home very much. But here's a story called from the back in time section called Motoring Memories. Entrepreneurial spirit of a fella here. A homemade gem blazed a trail. First, it was a travel camper, then a cool pad for the kids. This is written by Scott Sutherland of Pleasant View, Utah. He writes, born in Oregon in 1959, I was the second of four children. Our dad, Alan, was a white-collar worker. Mom, Bernice, was a part-time night nurse. Because they worked different shifts, we seldom had a babysitter. Nice recreational toys such as boats, planes, and travel trailers were uncommon then and out of reach for most people except the well-to-do. Mom and Dad were not in that league. However, like lots of parents back then, they improvised. Dad was good with his hands and had accumulated many tools. In the mid-1950s, a big new grocery store was going up in our town, and the refrigeration equipment was delivered to the site packed in oak crates. The builders allowed Dad to take away all of this discarded wood. Over time, my father also acquired an old trailer frame, upholstered seats from a remodeled restaurant, a sink, and other things from secondhand stores. Finally, it was time for him to start building the family's travel trailer. It took him several months, but by the next year, we were towing our homemade trailer to different camping sites in Oregon. And what a conversation piece it was, complete with a working sink, lights, closet, and enough room for all six of us. And there's a nice picture of this thing. It almost looks like an outdoor shed. You know, it's made out of wood with an asphalt rooftop, and it looks like he's got windows were cut out and curtains hanging down, and all these kids in a stair step photo, you might say, looks like the wife, Bernice, is holding one in her arms who looks to be about two, and then there's a little girl in a pink dress, looks to be maybe four. Another little boy standing next to her is dressed in a really nice blue suit with a bow tie. He's probably about six or seven, and his brother standing next to him is in a nice blue suit, and he looks probably around 10. So as the story goes on, Mom and Dad never owned more than a three-bedroom home. With four growing children in the house by the mid-1960s, Dad's travel trailer became a needed fourth bedroom for my brother Bob, the eldest. A few years later, once Bob had left for the Marines, I inherited the trailer to use as my bedroom. Eventually, I went into the Army, and the family had no further need for the trailer. Dad finally sold it. I often wonder what became of the homemade camper that served our family well for so many years. I hope whoever bought it enjoyed it as much as we did. And one kid gets to go live out in the tramper. That's quite nice. I know my sister was happy when I went off to college because Dad had to convert one of our porches to a bedroom when they were surprised by her birth, and we only had a two-bedroom house. So I can understand. Probably that was a better deal because the bathroom was in the house. Anyway, like that story. Here's a sidebar thing on the story here about the traveling set. Talk about seeing the country. This is by Mary Liz Shaw. Don't give a location of where she lived, but anyway, seeing the country by a travel trailer was a national pastime in the mid-century. Enthusiasts called them travelites or tin can tourists at a time when suburban households boasted big cars that could handily tow a 3,000-pound camper. The trailer market was fierce. A 1949 Billboard ad lists the models from 55 manufacturers. The Cozy Coach Company in Kalamazoo, Michigan, adopted the slogan, "Your head with a cozy coach behind," and set its models apart with superior materials like polished woods and homey touches like glass front kitchen cabinets. Its deluxe model sold for $765 in 1936, which would equivalent today of $14,000. Cozy coaches and other extinct trailer brands are our collector's items now. And you can see the Cozy Coach when it was a shiny and new in 1949. So thanks to Mary Liz Shaw for doing that and quite some stories about folks who love to camp. Here's one up on the retro department about collectibles. How many of you had a Lincoln log set as growing up? There's a lot of sticks of wood spark, a lot of creativity, writes Pat Goble Morris of San Diego, California. She writes, "Our imaginations took over when my brother Jim, sister Dolores, a.k.a. Dodie, and I brought out the Lincoln logs. It was the 1940s in Park Ridge, Illinois, and Jim had quite a collection. We built forts, houses, corrals and other farm buildings. When my granddaughters, Suzanne and Madeline, visited, I shared stories of my childhood. I also wanted them to have the same fun. So I spent about $300 buying sets. When the girls finally outgrew the Lincoln Logs, I advertised them online. A mother and her children came by, and when the kids saw the collection, their eyes lit up. Although I had hoped to recover my money, and the look in their eyes melted my heart. I packed everything into a 13-gallon bag and sold the lot for next to nothing. The joy on their faces still makes me smile. I love knowing someone else is having fun and building memories, too. That was quite a story there for Pat and Sister Dodie. They, Great Wars. This is an entry, a little story. My husband invented a combat game using a small rubber or plastic troops representing soldiers. Each side in the battle makes a five-foot-wide fortress using Lincoln Logs to defend its army. The ammunition consists of grapes pulled off artificial fruit bunches. At the word begin, each side throws grapes to knock the other team's soldiers. The side with the most troops standing wins. By Jacqueline Ventura, St. Louis, Missouri. Wonder how many times that game was played with real grapes. Kenneth Wheeler writes from Hanover, Pennsylvania. My favorite childhood toy in the mid-1950s was Lincoln Logs. My wife Sally and I recently visited an auction in South Central Pennsylvania, where I found a large, round wooden cheese box filled with Lincoln Logs. I made certain I won the bid. Now, which Lincoln was it? Abraham Lincoln or Frank Lincoln Wright? About come up with the idea of Lincoln Logs. The nod to be Abe Lincoln in the toy's name addressed both America's amped-up nostalgia for frontier living as urbanization grew and strong patriotism after World War I. Under Frank Lincoln Wright, evidence suggests the building set got its name from designer John Lloyd Wright's father, Frank, whose middle name was Lincoln, until he changed it to Lloyd. Never knew that, did you? Have you ever had a cricket in your house and had trouble finding it? Well, here's a story about a cricket chirp came from a bad earworm. It was a solo performance they couldn't tune out. This is by Nancy O'Connor, or Carpentier, Carpinteria, California. On the day my father left for a five-day conference, I rushed home from school to tell Mom I was finally understanding long division. But she had something else on her mind. A cricket must have hopped inside the piano, she said. It's been driving me crazy. I helped her lift the top of our antique Steinway Grand, but we couldn't see the insect. Mom called the pet store to see if there was such a thing as a cricket trap. There wasn't, but the manager suggested luring ours with a bit of carrot or potato. We went to bed that night, hoping to find the intruder eating its breakfast the next day. In the morning, I did encounter the cricket, chirping inside the piano. That afternoon, several neighbors stopped by to hear the one-note serenade. One put a stick in the Steinway, thinking the cricket could use it to crawl out. I kept watch, but the cricket was a no-show. Over the next few days, Mom retreated to the bedroom or the bathroom to escape the relentless chirping, and practically every neighbor on our street came by with different kinds of food to attract the insect. The poor piano was groaning under the weight. When Dad finally came home at the end of the week, he took one look at us and asked, "Is there something wrong?" So we related the saga of the cricket. As we spoke, my father leaned over the piano, at which point the stowaway, as if on cue, let out a beep. Then Dad did something unexpected. he reached behind the Steinway and grabbed the smoke alarm on the wall. The thing chirped in what sounded like delight, while Mom and I stared in complete disbelief. "It sounds like a cricket when it needs a new battery," Dad said. Mom collapsed on the couch with a groan. "Wait until the neighbors hear about this." That reminds me about the smoke alarm chirping, and my dad, who was about 90, was at home. He was at the home with a broom in his hand and said, "Well, that just kills your smoke alarm," as he knocked it off the ceiling. That was okay. I put it back together and put it up. Anyway, how about through Mrs. C's eyes, small kindnesses loom large as wife plows on, by Mike Cordell of Bremerton, Washington. The winter I was in the eighth grade in the early 1970s, a lot of snow dropped on our town, Kesilof, Alaska. That was fine by me, for my father would let me plow our 1,000-foot private road with the Little John Deere 1010 dozer. His only stipulation, I also had to plow the drive of our nearest neighbor, Mrs. C., a 75-year-old retired teacher. The thrill of clattering around on the John Deere was ample compensation, but it couldn't compare to Mrs. C. insisting in her charming English accent that I join her for tea and biscuits with Johnny Carson when I finished. Her father had come from England to seek his fortune during the Klondike Gold Rush, but he'd struck it rich in a different way. "I found all the gold I needed in your mother," he often told his daughter. The plowing done, I'd find Mrs. C. waiting inside with a hug and a compliment. "What a fine young man you are, Mike." Before she led me past her sleeping husband to a recliner next to the TV tray where she'd set the teapot, cups, bowl of sugar, pitcher of milk, and a plate of Lorna Doone cookies. She always tried to give me $5 for plowing, and I always refused. Truth be told, I looked forward to watching The Tonight Show almost as much as driving the plow, because we didn't have a TV at home. After a half hour or so, I'd thank her, hug her goodbye, and clank back up the hill on the old John Deere as she watched me from her doorway. The next winter, her husband Toby died. In our little community on the Kenai Peninsula, being a grave digger was a great honor. I was gratified when Mrs. C. asked me to be one of the four grave diggers for Toby. On that cold March day, Mrs. C.'s son and one of her nephews hacked at the ground with picks and shovels. They were sturdy men, both fishermen, but the first 3 feet of earth were frozen solid and came away in small pieces. I waited my turn to dig with Brock and C's 17-year-old grandson. When we finally finished, Mrs. C's son said a simple prayer and handed each of the other grave diggers an envelope with a new $100 bill. We understood that it wasn't a payment, but a token of her appreciation. Although I'm not as old as Mrs. C. was when we watched TV together, I am closer to her age now than I am to the teenager I was then. Because of her, I learned to say thank you often and to appreciate the best in people. Thank you, Mrs. C., for having made my world a better place. Now for a true love story. Stick to what you know. Just remember, beautiful young girls have mothers, too. This is by Douglas Maxson of Cedar Spring, Michigan. During the summer of 1966, I was 16 and often rode my bike to the Wednesday night youth meetings at the Free Methodist Church on Main Street. Many of my friends also went because the young pastor enjoyed being around teens and working with them. One night, I expected the usual crowd, but was distracted by a beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed girl sitting across the aisle several pews back. I asked one of my friends who she was. Tom told me she was Lorraine's cousin. Lorraine was Tom's girlfriend, and they had been dating for almost 2 years. If I was to confide in anyone about dating girls, Tom would be the one. Tom was a good friend, and I knew I could count on his help. His first piece of advice was to write a letter to the young lady telling her about myself and include a picture. Then he added, "That's all you need. I'll help you write some good stuff." Good stuff. The letter he wrote was filled with more X's and O's than an entire year of the dating game. All I had to do was sign my name, address the envelope, put on a stamp, and send it. I couldn't wait for her reply. After 2 weeks, I started to doubt the girl would ever write back. But eventually, I went to the mailbox and found a letter addressed to me. This was going to be the best day of my life. I took the envelope to my room so my mother wouldn't get suspicious. I carefully opened it and pulled out a picture. Great, I thought. She sent me hers. Not so fast. It was a picture I had sent her. As it turned out, the letter was addressed to me, but was written by the girl's mother, an entire page telling me that her daughter was much too young to get into a serious relationship with someone she had never met. She was courteous, but straightforward. The more I read, the more embarrassed and ridiculous I felt. So much for my friend Tom and his help. Never again did I trust someone else's advice in making a love connection. I stuck to reading comic books. And a little side part of this is Doug's vow to read comic books lasted until he met his wife Deborah at a Bible college in Cedar Springs. Anyway, I'll bet you have lots of stories that we could read here on the show from Reminisce Magazine. Why don't you take a chance and tell us your story? Your true tales are the heart of this magazine, so dust off that photo album, high school yearbook, or vacation diary. You know, there's lots of things to celebrate, so take a chance. Now, if you send in a photograph, please identify the people, the city, the state, and the year the photo was taken. For photos sent by mail, be sure your photo or reprint is in focus. Do not send photocopies. We cannot print from them. For photos sent digitally, scan your photo as a JPEG file at 1,200 by 1,800 pixels, 300 dpi, and 1 megabyte. No scanner? Walgreens, Office Max, FedEx, and Office offer this service. So go ahead and let me tell you. Oh, if you do a car, name that car, Attention Car Buffs. We're in the need of more name that car challenges. We'd love to see your cars and stuff. So be sure to let us know. You know, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts for the North Carolina Reading Service. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138.